Even though Eric and I would talk about our future, I told myself I knew that everything was going to change when he graduated. I led two separate but compatible lives that year. From Sunday to Thursday, I did all my reading and schoolwork. My roommates, the three Winonas, played loud music and smoked nonstop cigarettes, but were surprisingly quiet and relatively good-natured. I found I had a lot in common with Mermaids Winona, a bookworm who, like me, grew up idolizing Nancy Drew. On Thursday evening, I would go to St. Dunstan's Manor for the weekly party. I would bring my largest purse, packed with a change of clothes and a few of my toiletries, since I would always spend the night, and sometimes the weekend. From Friday morning until Sunday evening, Eric and I were rarely apart, with the exception of classes and Eric's racquetball matches, or Ultimate Frisbee, or any of the numerous pickup games that it was important for him to win. We saw movies at the campus repertory theater and would venture into Newchester to eat Italian food and would sometimes go to parties not hosted by St. Dunstan's or any of its members, but that was rare. We slid into a comfortable relationship filled with predictable routine, a day-to-day of inside jokes and what seemed to me to be some highly well-suited sex. We called one another Washburn and Kintner. We were blessedly free of the dramatics of disappointment or infidelity. I cherished what we had become, but kept it to myself, telling Eric and no one else how strong my attachment was. He echoed my feelings and sometimes talked of our future together after Mather. Eric's ex-girlfriend, Faith, was also a senior and still a regular at Thursday night parties. She was now dating Matthew Ford, and because Faith and I were respective girlfriends of the two most prominent members of St. Dunn's, Faith attached herself to me that year, even occasionally asking me questions about my relationship with Eric, although I never took the bait. I didn't particularly like Faith, who was bubbly and devious and liked to be the center of attention. But I didn't mind spending time with her. If Faith hadn't been around at all, curiosity about the girl who had spent 2 years with Eric might have escalated into obsession. But she was around, and I got to know her, and, because of that, she had no place in my imagination. I could see what had attracted Eric to Faith. She was round-faced and sexy, with short black hair. Her clothes were straight out of the official preppy handbook, but her sweaters were always a little too tight, and her skirts were always a little too short. When she talked, she came in close and made disarming eye contact, but she laughed often and made funny jokes about herself. If we went anywhere together, Faith would push her arm through mine, and if she was standing behind me, she would run her fingers through my hair. Neither of my parents had been physically affectionate with me, so I found Faith's touchiness often disturbing and occasionally reassuring. Once, when Faith was drunk, she told me she wanted to study the color of my eyes. She came in close, her own brown eyes huge in my vision. "It's like a tapestry in there," Faith said, her breath warm against my cheek. "There are flecks of gray and yellow and blue and brown and pink." Eric rarely spoke of Faith, but one night as we lay in his bed, he asked if it bothered me that Faith was around so much. "Not really," I said. "She's decided we're best friends. Have you noticed that?"
"She's best friends with everyone. No, delete that. I think she genuinely likes you and wants to be your friend. It's just that..."
"Don't worry, I know what you mean. I have no intention of becoming her best friend. I'm not sure we have anything in common, besides you."
"No, you have nothing in common. I can vouch for that. She's not a bad person, and she and Matt make a good pair."
"I guess so," I said. And that was the extent of our conversation on the subject of Faith. That summer, I returned to Monk's. My mother had a new boyfriend, Michael Bialik, a bearded linguistics professor from the university who was surprisingly grounded. He had his own place about a half mile from ours, a converted barn where he lived with his son, a piano prodigy named Sandy. Michael loved to cook, and because of this, my mother spent a lot of her time at his house, leaving Monk's to me. My library job was only 4 hours a day, Monday through Friday, and I spent the rest of my weekday time either reading or puttering around the property. I was in love, and I was at peace. I even returned to my favorite meadow, the final resting place of Chet. The well cover was still in place. It looked the way it had, years ago, when I had first discovered it. Hidden by winter-yellowed grass, the nearby farmhouse was still unoccupied. My plan had been to visit Eric in New York on the weekends, but when Eric came to visit Monk's, he fell in love with it. Or at least, he claimed he had. "I want to spend every weekend here, Kintner. This will be the perfect life. Weeks in the city, and then I can take the train out Friday evening and be here with you. Country weekends."
"You won't get bored?"
"Not a chance. I love it here. What about you? I'd be asking you to spend all your time here." "You're describing every summer I've ever had. I don't mind. And I'll have you to look forward to on the weekends." And so, our summer turned out to be a replication of our school year. Weeks alone, weekends together. I didn't mind because I had never minded spending time alone. And the days I spent alone were days that were getting me closer to the weekend, to seeing Eric step off the commuter train, overnight bag slung across his shoulders, huge grin on his face. And these weekends were that much more intense. Away from Mather, our relationship seemed more mature, more comfortable. We felt married. So no, I didn't mind just seeing Eric 2 days each week. And Eric didn't mind, for reasons of his own. I might never have found out about those reasons, and might have left for London in the fall feeling as though Eric was still the love of my life. If it hadn't been for my father's visiting New York in the last week of August and asking to see me for lunch. He had a new book coming out, a collection of short stories, and he was in New York to meet with his American agent and his American publisher, and to give a reading at Strand Books. He hadn't invited me to the reading, which wasn't a surprise. I'd asked him once, my junior year of high school, I think, if I could go to one, and he'd replied, "God, Lily, you're my daughter. I wouldn't expose you to that. It's bad enough you'll eventually feel the need to read my books, let alone have to listen to me speak them out loud." So I took a day off from the library and caught the train to New York City. My father and I ate lunch in a swank restaurant attached to the lobby of his Midtown hotel, and we talked about my upcoming year in London. He promised to email me a list of friends and relatives I had to visit, along with a few of his favorite London landmarks, most of which were pubs. Then he drilled me for tidbits about my mother and the new boyfriend. He was very disappointed to hear that the linguistics professor was, on the whole, a decent man. After lunch, we parted ways in front of the hotel.
"You turned out all right, Lil, despite your mother and me," he said, not for the first time.
We hugged goodbye. It was a strangely nice day for late August in the city, so I headed downtown toward Eric's office, a place I had never visited. The air that had been stifling for the entire month was suddenly free of humidity, and I was just happy to be walking along the quiet midday corridors of the city. I hadn't decided whether I would intrude on Eric's workday to surprise him or not, but was considering it, beginning to imagine the look on his face as I stepped into his office. I was taken out of this reverie by hearing someone shout my name. I turned to see Katie Stone, a junior at Mather and someone I knew from St. Dunstan's parties, crossing the street and waving at me.
"I thought that was you," Katie said, stepping onto the curb as a yellow cab hurtled by. "I didn't know you were in the city this summer."
I'm not. I'm at my mom's house in Connecticut, but my dad's here and I had lunch with him.
Do you want to get coffee?
I got let out of work early. God, New York's depressing in August. We went to a chain coffee shop at the nearest corner and both ordered iced lattes. Katie prattled on about Mather students we both knew and several I'd never heard of. She was a gatherer and purveyor of gossip, and I was surprised that she wasn't asking me about Eric. So I asked her, "Do you see Eric much?" Katie's eyes widened a little at the mention of his name.
"Oh, I wasn't going to bring him up. No, not much, but a little. He works around here somewhere, you know."
"Yeah, I know. Why weren't you going to bring him up?"
"I just didn't know how you felt, now that you're not seeing each other. I didn't know if you wanted to hear about him."
A cold flush went over my skin. I very nearly told Katie that, of course, I was still seeing Eric, but something stopped me. Instead, I asked, "Why? What's going on with him?"
"Nothing that I know of. I've seen him a little, but he's never here on the weekends. His dad's sick. Maybe you knew that?"
"No," I said. "What's wrong with him?"
"Cancer, I think. Eric goes there every weekend. They must be close."
She phrased it like a question, and I managed to nod, despite the sudden need to get out of the coffee shop and away from Katie. Fortunately, Katie's cell phone began to ring, and as she dug within her enormous purse, I excused myself. I borrowed the key from the barista, then locked myself into the closet-size restroom. My mind galloped, desperately trying to understand the information I had just received. And while there was a part of me that was questioning what Katie had said, that it must be some ridiculous misunderstanding, there was a more logical part of me that knew it was true, that I had been a fool. Eric was leading two lives, and no one knew that he was seeing me on the weekends. After returning the key, I saw that Katie was still on her phone, and I took the opportunity to tap her briefly on the shoulder, point at my watch, and move quickly toward the door. Katie lowered the phone and stood, but I simply mouthed the word "sorry" and kept moving. Once outside, I went down a residential side street. One of the brownstones had stone front steps that were shaded by a leafy tree. I crouched high up on the steps, not caring if the owner spotted me and told me to leave. I don't know how long I sat on those steps, but it was probably about 2 hours. I felt miserable for some of that time, but pretty soon I began to feel calm. I analyzed the situation. Eric had compartmentalized his life with me so that it only happened on the weekends and never in the city. It was the way he operated. It was the way he had operated at college, but why was he lying about where he was on the weekends? There could be only one reason: that Eric was involved with someone here in New York. A little before 5 o'clock, I walked down toward Eric's office building. I knew the address, but not what it looked like. I walked slowly, my eyes scanning the crowd. I knew that I would not be able to handle running into Eric, but I wasn't ready to leave the city yet. I wanted to see where he worked, maybe even see him without letting him see me. His office was in a nondescript 4-story stone building next to a Gray's Papaya. I sat on a bench across from its entrance and pulled a New York Post from a nearby trash can, unfolding it in front of me, but keeping my eyes on the building's front doors. At a little after 5, a few men in suits, plus one woman in a skirt and blouse, emerged. No Eric, but he came out in the next group of 3 men. He wore a light gray suit, and as the 3 men hit the sidewalk, they all simultaneously lit cigarettes. I wasn't surprised to see Eric smoking, even though he'd told me he quit on the day of graduation. He'd never once smoked a cigarette while visiting me in Connecticut on the weekend, but that was because he was 2 people. His co-workers, their cigarettes lit,
began walking downtown, but Eric stood for a moment, glancing at his phone. A yellow cab pulled up, and I thought that Eric was going to get into it. But instead, a redhead in a retro mini dress got out and kissed Eric on the mouth as he flicked away his cigarette. They spoke for a moment, Eric's hand on the curve of her hip. My chest hurt, and the world shimmered in front of my eyes. And for a brief moment, I thought I was having a heart attack. Then the worst of it passed. I straightened my back and took a deep breath, studying the girl. She looked familiar, but I had yet to see her face. The fact that she was also a redhead was a twist of the knife, even though I could tell from this distance that this woman's hair came from a hairstylist and not from genetics. Eric and the redhead turned, and for one horrible moment I thought they were going to step off the curb and cross the street toward me, but they headed north, arms linked. I watched them from over my newspaper and finally caught a good look at the face of Eric's city girlfriend. It was Faith, a red-headed Faith. Looking back, I wasn't really surprised at all that it was Faith. Of course it was. But I remember being shocked by the way she had changed her looks, her hair now red, like mine. And I was angry. I was the angriest I'd been in years.
Chapter 11. Ted. Before saying goodbye at the Concord River Inn, after we had decided that it made sense for me to spend some time in Maine with Brad and Miranda, Lily and I had planned our next meeting. It was to be two Saturdays from our first meeting at the same time, but in the old Hill Burying Ground, a hillside cemetery that rose above Monument Square in Concord Center. There were benches there, and we could sit beside one another and talk, and we would be less visible than we had been at the inn's tavern. I showed up early that Saturday afternoon. There were tourists in town, but none of them were on the hill. I sat alone on a cold, wrought-iron bench, looking out over the shingled roofs toward Main Street. The sky was low and the color of granite. A steady, purposeful wind blew colored leaves through the air. I looked for Lily, studying the cars that circled Monument Square, even though I had no idea what kind of car Lily drove. I tried to guess. Something classic, I thought, but with just a little bit of flair. A vintage BMW, maybe, or an original Austin Mini. But when I spotted Lily, she wasn't coming out of a car, but walking briskly down Main Street, wearing a knee-length green coat, her red hair bouncing with each step. I watched her walk toward the cemetery, losing sight of her when she dipped below the roof lines. I felt a surge of excitement that I was going to see her again. Part of that was my burgeoning romantic fixation. But I was also excited to tell her about my trip, and to tell her about the key I'd stolen from Brad that opened his front door. In a way, I felt like a child bringing home a good report card to my mother. Lily came back into view along the cemetery's flagstone path. She smiled at me before sitting down on the opposite side of the bench. "Quite the view," she said, her voice slightly breathless from the steep hill. "I saw you coming down Main Street. Could you tell you were being watched?" "No, I wasn't even thinking about it. I was worried I was late and that you would have left." "Oh, I wouldn't have left. I have too much to tell you." She turned toward me. In the gray October light, her face seemed bleached of color, while her hair was redder than I remembered, an alarmingly alive color among the monochrome graves. I wanted to reach out and touch her, to make sure she was real, but held back. "You went to Maine?" she asked. "I did," I said, then told her the story of my week, of the time spent with Brad, of being in his house and taking his key. "You don't think he'll miss it?" she asked. "I don't. He had a whole pile of them in his drawer. It's a business he runs, so I assume he needs lots of keys. For all I know, those are masters that open all of the cottage doors." "Well, it can only be helpful. Just remember to make sure that after all of this happens, you get rid of that key, or leave it back in his house. You can never get caught with any kind of physical evidence. You know that." I nodded, and Lily asked, "What else did you find out about your house? Is there a completion date?" I told her that Brad had told me that he expected to be done with his work in early December, early January at the latest. That means we need to act relatively fast. It's important that it happens before the house is finished, I think. We created a plan where I would need to be and when and what we would both be doing. Billy discussed it as if we were a couple of seniors in high school discussing who would be doing what when we presented our final science project. I was a detail-oriented person. I had to be, for the work I did and the money I made, and my natural inclination was that I should be taking notes. But I knew that nothing could be written down. Ever. As Lily had said earlier, this would be the last time we saw each other before I became a widower, and then we could meet again, accidentally, as though we'd never met before. As we talked, and as I memorized what needed to be done, I felt the start of some tightness in my chest, a feeling of constriction in my throat and jaw. I tilted my head. My neck cracked. "You okay?" Lily asked. "Fine. It's just becoming real. It was one thing to plan my scouting trip to Maine, but this is a little different." Lily straightened up, pulled her lower lip under her upper. There was concern in her eyes. "You don't have to go through with this, you know," she said. "This is for you and not for me, and the last thing I want is for you to do something that will haunt you for the rest of your life." "I'm not scared of that. Maybe I'm worried about something going wrong." "If we do this the way we're planning, then nothing will go wrong. Let me ask you. If there were an earthquake today in Maine and Miranda and Brad were killed, how would you feel?" "I would be happy," I said, "without having to think about it. It would solve all my problems, and they would deserve it." "That's all we're doing, then. We're creating an earthquake, one that will bury them both. And if we do it right, everyone, including the police detectives assigned to the case, will naturally assume that Miranda was murdered by Brad and that Brad skipped town. All their efforts will go toward finding him, and they never will. They might suspect you briefly. It would be strange if they didn't. But nothing they find will point them toward you, and your alibi is going to be rock solid." "Okay, I trust you." "Look, if at any point you decide you don't want to do this, then just let me know. But if you're worried about something going wrong, I don't think you need to worry. If we stay sharp and do everything the way we planned it, you're not even going to be a suspect. Miranda and Brad will get what they deserve, and not only that, but think of the sympathy you'll receive. Your beautiful young wife killed by her brutish lover. You'll be fighting them off with a stick." Lily was smiling. She pushed a strand of hair off her forehead. "Just for the record," I said, "that's not my motive." "No? No, not unless you... you were volunteering for the position." Lily was still smiling. "Ah, the plot thickens. Or thins," I said. She laughed. "Right, or thins." We looked at each other for a moment, and Lily's smile faded. She hunched her shoulders and buttoned her coat a little higher. "Cold?" I asked. "A little. Should we walk around? I've never been here before." I agreed, and we strolled among the tottering, time-worn gravestones, Lily's arm through mine. We moved comfortably together, not having to talk, as though we were an old couple with years and years of memories between us. We read some inscriptions, most commemorating lives lived in the 18th century. Many cut short at ages that nowadays would be deemed a tragedy. But they had had lives, and no matter how young they had been when they died, they would still all be long gone by now. Some of the gravestones had lettering that had worn away, to unreadable hieroglyphs, and many depicted winged skulls, and the words, "Memento mori," "Remember that you will die." I ran a finger over one of the carvings, a skull in the shape of a light bulb with round owl's eyes and a full set of teeth. Between the skull and the inscription were two sets of crossed bones. "I wonder when they stopped putting death imagery on gravestones," I said. "It's so appropriate." "Yeah, it is," Lily said, pulling me in closer with her arm. The cemetery dipped a little on its far side, and we found ourselves below its highest ledge and underneath a tree, still festooned in yellow leaves. Almost simultaneously we turned, and I took Lily in my arms, and we kissed. I unbuttoned her coat and slid my arms inside of it, around her waist. Her sweater felt like cashmere. She shivered. "Still cold?" I asked. "No," she said, and we kissed more, the kiss getting wetter, each of us pulling the other closer into our bodies. I ran a hand up the front of her sweater, feeling the ridges of her ribs, then the small swell of a breast, a hard nipple. The sound of a branch snapping made us each turn our heads. On the cemetery's bluff, a lone figure crouched, taking a photograph of one of the gravestones. We broke apart, but continued to look at each other. "We should call it a day," she said. "Okay." My voice was a little hoarse. "Do you know the plan? Should we go over it again?" "I've got it. All up here." I tapped my forehead. "Okay, then." Neither of us immediately moved. "So afterward," I said, "can we continue this?" "I'd like that." "And you'll tell me all your secrets?" "I will. I'll tell you everything. I'm looking forward to it." I remembered the half-joke I had made at the Concord River Inn, asking her how many people she had killed. Again I asked myself who I was becoming involved with. Again I told myself I didn't care. "We should leave here separately." "I know. Before we wind up in one of that man's photographs." I looked up at the bluff. The man was standing now, peering through his camera along a line of leaning gravestones. "I'll go first," Lily said. "Okay. Until next time." "Right. Until then. And good luck." She walked away from me, up and over the cemetery's ridge, the man with the camera never even turning to watch her. I stayed where I was, the taste of her lips still on mine. I zipped up my coat and shoved my hands deep into my pockets. The sky, still the color of granite, had brightened a little, so that I squinted as I watched her. For the first time since I decided to kill my wife, I wanted it to happen right away. I felt like a kid the week before Christmas, the days stretching out, each one a miniature version of eternity. I wanted Miranda dead. She had taken our love and made a mockery of it. She had made a mockery of me. I kept thinking of the way that Miranda used to look at me, still looked at me sometimes, like I was the center of her universe. And then she had ripped out my heart. And how could I share the money I had made with the woman who had done that, who had ripped out my heart like it didn't mean a thing to her? This was my reason, and I told myself I believed in it. But I had a new reason. I had Lily. I was doing this because of Lily. I was going to kill my wife, so that I could be with her. And this reason made more sense than any of the others.
Chapter 12. Lily. There was one full weekend before my flight to London for my year abroad, and I told Eric that I had a terrible late summer cold, and maybe he shouldn't come. He agreed, on the condition that I let him drive me to the airport on the Tuesday that I flew from JFK. I thought it would be harder, those couple of hours with him in his car, but they were easy. I just told myself to act like nothing had happened. Over the summer, Eric and I had discussed my year in London several times. I'd given him the chance to express any reservations, but he had insisted that we should stay together, continue to be mutually exclusive. His first visit was scheduled for October, 6 weeks after my arrival. Eric had already bought the ticket, so when we said goodbye at the loading zone at JFK, Eric said, "6 weeks feels like a long time, but it isn't really. We'll see each other soon." "Hey," I said, "this is going to sound strange, but I want you to know that if you think this separation is too long, I would understand. If you want to take a break, be with someone else, I won't like it, but I won't hold it against you. Right now is the time to tell me, not later." He looked concerned, his eyes locking into mine. "Is that what you want?" "No, not at all, but I want you to tell me the truth. I wouldn't respond well if you cheated on me."
"You never have to worry about that. Ever."
I searched his face for any signs of deceit. It was something I had done for many years living with my parents, and I had come to regard myself as someone who could tell when I was being lied to. But I saw nothing in Eric's face, except love and sincerity. "I can't wait to see you in October," I said, and held him tight for a moment, while a trapped Range Rover behind us sounded its horn. In a way, I wasn't lying. I was now looking forward to Eric's trip to visit me. That face he had made, that innocent, loving face, had sealed his fate.
I didn't know how I was going to do it yet, but I did know that I would find a way to punish Eric when he came to visit me in London. The Fonts Institute of Art accepted just a few foreign students per year, so for my orientation week, I was at a hotel in Russell Square, mixed in with about 40 American students, all attending something called the Overseas Academy for Foreign Study, a college that catered exclusively to American college students on their year abroad. In that week, along with a meet-and-greet and some orientation sessions, we were expected to form groups and look for housing. We were given a list of real estate agents that specialized in temporary flats and told that our best chance of finding something was to form groups of either 4 or 6. As it turned out, many of the American students had already come over from their respective colleges in groups. I was wondering if it would be possible to find a studio flat just for myself when I was approached by a pretty student gripping her list of agents.
"Have you found a group?" she asked.
"Not yet. You?"
"No, but my older sister did this program, and she told me that they tell you that it's easiest to be in a big group, but that's a lie. They just want you to be in big groups for some reason, and that it's much easier to find a flat for just two, and so I looked around and I saw you."
She said this all in one rush and with a sharp Texas twang. "I'd be willing to share if you want to," I said, glad to have met someone who seemed to know a little bit about the process of renting a flat. She bounced a little, her long brown hair jumping on her shoulders.
"Oh, goody. All these groups are boys and girls, and don't get me wrong, I like boys, but I'd just as soon not share a flat with one of them. My name's Addison Logan. My family all call me Addie, but I thought I might try out my full name, Addison, while I was here in London. But you can call me what you want to call me."
"I'm Lily Kintner," I said, and we shook hands. It took us 2 days of looking, but we finally found a one-bedroom basement flat along an Edwardian block of mansion flats in Maida Vale. It was a long tube ride from the Fonts Institute and from Addison's classes, but it was in the nicest neighborhood we'd been shown. Addison told me it was the only place we'd seen that didn't make her want to take a shower right away, so I agreed. I called my father, who was a visiting writer that semester somewhere in California, to tell him I'd taken a flat in Maida Vale, and he said how posh I was, mentioned a pub called the Prince Alfred, and ended by telling me that the only bad thing about London's all the bloody American students. Addison and I turned out to be good roommates, mostly because our schedules meant we rarely saw each other. About 3 weeks after our arrival, I began to see even less of her because she had started dating a fellow Texan in her program who had a flat in Camden Town. "I know it's lame that I come all the way to London and end up dating some kid from Lubbock named Nolan, but he's a cute kid."
"Don't apologize to me," I said.
"When's your boyfriend? Eric, right? When's he coming again?"
I told her, and she promised to be out of my hair during his visit. I insisted that it didn't matter either way, even though I did want Addison to stay away while Eric was here. Along with immersing myself in my schoolwork at the Institute and exploring London's bookstores and museums, I had been spending my time trying to figure out a way to kill Eric and get away with it. And I was pretty sure that I had figured it out. The first part of my plan hinged on Eric's competitive nature. I had spent enough time watching him play pool at St. Dunn's to know just how much he hated to lose. He tried to hide it, but when he lost, especially to someone he didn't like, his eyes would go blank, and he would find a way to play that person again and to win. And just this past summer, when Eric visited me at Monk's, he'd asked me about the huge oak in the backyard. He'd spotted the two faded colored flags that had been nailed into its trunk, one at about the three-quarters mark and one near the top. I explained that one summer my father's best friend from childhood had come for a month, and how they had taken turns climbing the oak, each trying to get his flag higher than the others. It had gone on for weeks, only ending when my father, drunk,
fell off the first branch one night and broke his wrist. After telling Eric this story, I knew that he would have to try and climb the tree. And he did. It took him several tries, but he made it higher than either my father or my father's friend had.
"How do you think your father would feel if I put my own flag up there?"
I laughed. "I don't think he'd care at all. He'd be amused."
"I don't need to, but if he thought he'd find it funny."
"Have you always been this competitive?" He frowned at me.
"I don't think I'm that competitive. You should see my brother."
At the time, I chalked Eric's denial up to a lack of self-knowledge. But now I saw it as part of his fraudulent nature. He genuinely did not want people to know about his driving desire to win at all costs. It gave away too much of himself. And it gave away a part of himself that was unchangeable. So, when I heard about the beer challenge at the Bottle and Glass, a dowdy pub at the end of my avenue, I knew that I could get Eric to attempt it. I didn't need him to be drunk for what I had planned, but it would definitely help. He arrived in London on a cold, wet Saturday. Addison, true to her word, packed a bag on Friday evening to spend a few days with Nolan.
"Honey, you must be so excited," she said.
"I am," I said.
"Well, try and look it."
"I'm just nervous," I said. "I don't really know why, but I am."
"That'll go away in about 5 minutes after he gets here. You just both need to get laid."
She laughed and covered her mouth with a hand. Eric's flight had left New York the previous night and was scheduled to land around 8 in the morning. I'd emailed him directions on how to get to my flat. I hadn't been lying to Addison when I said I was nervous, but I wasn't nervous about what I planned on doing to Eric. I was nervous about the time we needed to spend together before I put my plan into action. I knew that he'd probably want to have sex as soon as he arrived, and I was steeling myself to go through with it. I told myself it was a test, a way to see how I really felt about him. I knew that being with Eric would never change my feelings about the way in which he had betrayed me, but I did wonder if it might change my plans to end his life. I doubted it, but it was a way to find out. And if all went according to plan, Eric would only be around for another 12 hours. I could manage. The buzzer sounded at 9:30, and I walked up the brief flight of stairs to the chipped marble landing to let him in. He looked tired and wrinkled from the flight, his hair sticking out in the back. We hugged and kissed, and I led him down to the basement flat, showed him around.
"You must be exhausted," I said.
"I am, but I don't want to sleep all day. Maybe I'll take a nap and then we can go somewhere."
"There's a good pub down the street, the Bottle and Glass."
"Okay, just let me sleep. 1 hour tops, and only if you join me."
I told him to get into the bed, and I'd join him later, hoping he would fall asleep. But after he entered the bedroom, and after I'd killed 15 minutes by slowly making myself a cup of tea, I decided I actually did want to join him. It was not just a test. It was a way of saying goodbye. I entered the small, dark bedroom. Eric shifted under the covers, and I could hear his steady breathing. I took off all my clothes and slid in behind him. He stirred but didn't wake. He was naked too, and the feel of his long, warm body against mine didn't make me cringe the way I thought it would. I ran a hand along his hard chest, down his flat stomach, and touched his penis. He instantly became hard, mumbling something into the pillow that I didn't understand, then slowly turned toward me. I spread my legs and moved him between them. He began to say something, but I pulled his head down so that it was beside mine. His hair smelled unwashed, but good. I guided him into me, then pulled the sheet and blanket over our heads. And we made love in that smothering, dark cave, neither of us talking, moving together in a slow, sleepy rhythm. He fell asleep again after we finished, and I slid away from him, pushing the sheets down around my waist. The cool air felt good against my naked torso, my skin damp with sweat. I thought about what I planned to do to Eric later that night and tried to feel bad about it. I compared him with Chet, who wanted to have sex with a child, but at least Chet didn't pretend to love anyone. Eric was bad through and through. Someone who would go through life taking only what he wanted and hurting the ones who loved him. I had handed him my love, my life, really, and he had treated each with disdain. Eric woke, disoriented and starving, a little after noon. He showered and dressed, and we went out to explore my neighborhood. I took him to a takeaway spot, and we bought sandwiches and drinks, and brought them to a small park called Rembrandt Gardens that abutted a canal. It had stopped raining, but the skies were still low and dark, and water dripped from the trees and puddled everywhere. I spread my jacket along a wooden bench, and we sat and ate the sandwiches, finishing them just as a sparse rain began to patter at the leaves above us. "Sorry for the weather," I said.
"It's pub weather," he said.
"Ready to get a drink? The bottle's not too far from here. No attempting their beer challenge, though. That's all I ask."
"What's that?"
It was all I had to do. When we arrived at the Bottle and Glass, a pub that was plain and boxy by London standards, with uncarpeted floors and wooden benches, Eric read about the beer challenge and studied the names of those who had succeeded. To be immortalized on the bottle's walls, all you had to do was drink one pint each of the pub's 10 draft beers, in the order in which they were lined up behind the bar, in the space of 5 hours. They monitored your toilet visits to make sure you didn't throw up. Eric told me it didn't sound particularly hard. I had thought the same thing and brought it up to Stuart, the bartender, the previous week. He said the combination of beers, from porters to bitters to pilsners and ciders, was a rough ride and was much harder than it looked. He'd seen many a beefy guy give up, or throw up, before the end. "I'm doing it," Eric said, to both me and that day's bartender, an older woman I hadn't seen before.
"Seriously? Eric?"
I said, as the bartender said, "Right, love," and produced a sign-in sheet.
"Print your name here where it says start, along with the time, and I'll initial it. When you've finished your 10th pint, all you've got to do is walk back up to this bar, sign your name at the end, and the rest is up to you. Most of them lose their last few pints in the toilet."
I complained a little more, just for show, but I knew Eric wouldn't change his mind. The first beer was a Fuller's ESB, and I joined him. We took our pints to a corner table. "I'm on vacation," he said, then took a long swallow. "I don't want you to be sick the whole time you're here."
"I won't be. 10 pints in 5 hours, not a problem."
I stayed for about 3.5 hours. It was clear that Eric was determined to finish the challenge, but he was on his 7th pint, a porter, and drinking it fairly slowly.
"I'm more full than anything," he said, but his words, from jet lag and from beer, were thick-sounding in his mouth.
"Let's call it quits," I said. "I'm sick of sitting in this pub."
"I'm not going to come this far and then quit."
He looked around. Some of the locals who had showed up around quitting time had taken notice of Eric's attempt to make it onto the wall. I knew that Eric would keep going, no matter what.
"Then I'm leaving. I'm starving, and I don't want to keep eating crisps. I'll get takeout Indian food and have it at the flat."
"I'm sorry, Lily." Don't be sorry. Have fun. Try not to puke at the bar, and I'll see you in a couple of hours. You know how to get back?
Just down the street, right?
I left. It was dusk, the bloated sky a dark purple, and there was a fine mist in the air. I walked straight to the corner Indian restaurant that I'd been to many times. I ordered a Rogan Josh and a chicken korma, plus a Coke to drink while I waited for the food. No nuts in the Rogan Josh? I asked as the owner rung up my order. I knew the answer, but I wanted to be on the record as asking.
No nuts in the Rogan Josh, but yes, cashews in the chicken korma.
Right, I know, thanks. I took the bags of food back to the flat. I left them on the small wooden table in the kitchen and went into the bedroom to look through Eric's suitcase. He'd brought several changes of clothes, one up on Wall Street by Peter Lynch, and a running outfit. His two EpiPens were in a plastic sandwich bag in an interior zippered pocket. He should have had one of them with him. I told him that 100 times, but I knew that he wouldn't. His nut allergy was fatal, but it was vanity that kept him from taking the pens around with him.
What am I supposed to do, Kittner, wear them in a fanny pack?
He convinced himself that he would never eat anything in public that would remotely have the chance of having nuts in it. I took the EpiPens and shoved them under the mattress. Then went back to the kitchen. I was hungry and ate some of the Indian food directly from the containers before dumping the chicken korma into a wide bowl. I spread the chicken and its yellow sauce out evenly and methodically picked out every cashew, placing them onto the stone mortar I'd found in one of the cluttered cabinets of our kitchen. When I was sure that I had found every cashew, I got the pestle and ground half of them up into a fine paste, then mixed the cashew paste back into the korma, and put everything back in its container. I took the remaining cashews, placed them in a folded piece of paper towel, and hid them behind the condiments in the fridge. I washed the mortar and pestle, plus the bowl, and put them back where I'd found them. I put the containers of Indian food in the flat's quarter-size refrigerator. Chicken korma was one of Eric's favorite, and the restaurant we'd gotten it from in Newchester never put nuts into it. The stage was set. All I needed to do now was wait. I tried to read Gaudy Night, but had trouble concentrating. I wasn't nervous exactly, but I wanted it to be over with. Eric had started his challenge at around 1:30, so he would be finished, one way or another, at 6:30. At about 6:15, the harsh din of the door buzzer sounded. I jerked upright. I wondered if he'd given up. But when I got to the front door and opened it, I found Addison. She was crying, her shoulders hitching up and down, and searching through her purse for the key.
Chapter 13. Ted. My junior year at Dartford Middleham High School, I asked a sophomore girl named Rebecca Rast to the junior prom. She was a popular blonde student I'd gotten to know while we both worked at the school newspaper. She seemed happy when I asked her, even though I knew she was more interested in the school's jocks. It was fine with me. I was just looking for a date. But a week before the prom, I ran into Rebecca at a beer party at an abandoned military base the next town over. I'd heard about these parties, but had never gone to one. About 100 students were there, cars parked on the broken asphalt of the base's old parking lot, the kids milling around the sloping hill on the south side of the boarded-up buildings. Most of the kids had brought six-packs lifted from their parents' homes, or bought by older brothers and sisters. I'd come in with my best friend Aaron, who was, like me, neither popular nor an outcast. Before getting out of our cars, we had nearly turned back, intimidated by the scene, and embarrassed that we had brought no alcohol. But then I spotted Rebecca clambering out of a nearby convertible with a bunch of her girlfriends, and I convinced myself that I should at least say hello to the girl who would be going with me to the prom the following week. To my surprise, she seemed thrilled to see me, and we spent most of the party together, drinking warm beers on the hill, then exploring the abandoned base. We wound up on a low, flat roof that we reached by a rusted fire escape. We stared at the stars, the beer we'd drunk making them slide in and out of focus. Then we started to kiss. It was a warm spring night, and Rebecca wore a midriff-bearing halter top and a short denim skirt. She let me touch her everywhere, at one point whispering to me that we should slow down unless I had a condom. I didn't, but lying in bed later that night, I told myself that I needed to get one as soon as possible, and definitely before prom night. It was an exhilarating thought, but more exhilarating was the fact that I had my first girlfriend. On the evening of the prom, I picked Rebecca up at her parents' modest house near Middleton Pond. While Rebecca's mother took pictures, her father leaned against his Dodge Dart, smoking a cigar and giving me icy looks from under a Patriot's cap. I was glad when we were safely in my car on the way to the Holiday Inn where the prom was being held. Rebecca wore a light blue dress with a low neckline. Her hair was French braided, and she smelled like vanilla. Despite some bad nerves on my part, the first few hours of the prom went well. Rebecca was chatty and flirty. We ate the dried-out chicken cordon bleu and danced several times. During one of the slow dances, I gently kissed Rebecca on the side of her head. She pulled me in closer to her, and I thought about that foil-wrapped condom hidden behind my driver's license in my wallet. It wasn't until about 20 minutes before the end of the prom that everything fell apart. I'd gone to the bathroom, and when I returned, Rebecca was no longer at our table. I spotted her on the far side of the ballroom, leaning up against the wall and talking to a junior I recognized as Bill Johnson, a linebacker on the school football team. I stopped in my tracks, my limbs turning cold and my throat tightening. Instead of crossing the endless yardage of the room to confront them, I went back to my table, and it was from there that I watched Rebecca and Bill hug, then kiss, then leave the prom together. I saw Rebecca in the hallway of the high school on Monday afternoon. I thought she might apologize, but I watched as her eyes skidded over me, and she turned away. I learned that week that she and Bill were definitely an item. I don't know if it was easier or harder that very few of my fellow students seemed aware that I'd been humiliated on prom night. I do know that if Rebecca had at least attempted to apologize to me, things might have turned out differently. I plotted my revenge for over a year. It made sense that if I was going to do something to Rebecca, I should wait for some time to pass. Otherwise, I'd be a natural suspect. I devoted my senior year to getting the best grades I could, keeping my head down and not allowing myself to get into any more potentially humiliating situations. I was accepted at Harvard, surprising even my guidance counselor. And while this acceptance felt like one kind of revenge, I still wanted to pay Rebecca back. Ideally, I would find a way to humiliate her in the way she had humiliated me, but I couldn't figure out a way to do that. I opted for my second choice. I would scare her very, very badly. A week before graduation, I parked my Ford Escort at the back parking lot of Arnie's Liquors on a sunless afternoon, then walked through a brief stretch of state forest that led to the back of the Rast's house. If anyone saw me, they would have seen a kid wearing a denim jacket and a baseball cap pulled low, something I would normally have never worn. But no one saw me. I had brought a crowbar in my backpack to break through the back door, but it was already open. I knew that no one would be home, that Mr. Rast had left months ago, and that Mrs. Rast worked day shifts at the CVS. And I knew, I hoped, that Rebecca would be coming home alone after school let out at 3 o'clock. I hid in her bedroom closet and waited. Thinking back on it now, I remember the terror and excitement I felt in the small, dark space, Rebecca Rast's clothes rustling up against me, the ski mask on my face starting to make me sweat. I had the closet door cracked a little and was able to hear Rebecca's car pull into the driveway, to hear her enter the house and walk slowly up the stairs. She went to the bathroom first, for what seemed like a long time. Then the toilet flushed, and she entered her bedroom, humming tunelessly to herself. My heart was thudding so loudly in my chest that I wondered how she hadn't heard it. I had planned on leaping out of the closet in my ski mask, but I didn't need to. She came straight to the closet door and slid it open along its tracks. I stepped toward her, scissors in one hand, duct tape in another. She opened her mouth to scream, but nothing came out. I watched all the color drain from her face, and I was sure that she was about to faint, but instead she turned to run. I tackled her from behind, realizing as I did it that she had stripped to just her underwear. I held her down and managed to wrap duct tape first around her face and mouth, and then around her hands and ankles. It wasn't easy. I got kicked several times, but refrained from making any noise, from letting her know who I was. After she was securely bound in duct tape, I dragged her into the closet, and before I shut the door, I ran the edge of the scissors along her neck. Her eyes were squeezed shut, tears coming out of them. I could smell the sharp tang of urine. I dumped the coat, the ski mask, the scissors, the crowbar, and the backpack into the dumpster behind the liquor store. I drove home shaking, my emotions alternating between enormous satisfaction that I had paid Rebecca back for the pain she had caused me, and a sickening shame that I had gone too far. Those feelings lasted through the summer, the shame temporarily replaced by the horrible fear that I was going to get caught. I would be publicly shamed and sent to prison, and I wouldn't get to go to Harvard. But the police never showed up, and as the summer progressed, I began to believe I'd gotten away with it. I did hear about the incident once, from a gossipy friend of mine named Molly. She told me that Rebecca Rast, you know her, right? Oh my God, you went to the prom with her, didn't you? Had been assaulted in her own home, tied up and left in the closet, and that everyone thought it was her own father, that creepy dude who used to work at a gas station. That was all I ever heard about it. I still dream about Rebecca Rast. In these nightmares, and they are definitely nightmares, Rebecca dies the night I duct-taped her and left her in the closet. In these dreams, I'm plagued with guilt and terrified of being caught, and I can never remember whether I meant to murder her or whether I meant to just scare her. But either way, I am a murderer, and that knowledge has taken over my life. On the Friday morning that Miranda was flying down to Miami Beach for a bachelorette party, I woke, having had one of these dreams. I was alone in the bed, and I lay there for a moment, the images from the nightmare flashing in my brain, then disappearing. At first I thought it was a Rebecca Rast dream, but then I realized that the person in the dream that I had killed had been Miranda. I'd trapped her in Rebecca Rast's closet, and she had died there. Other images from the dream came back to me. A funeral where no one would look at me. The terrible fear that I forgot to hide the body. An image of my father, water coming from his nose, a field that I was frantically digging in. For one terrible moment, I thought that these weren't pictures from my dreams but recent memories. I'd had this feeling before, always when I was in the half-state between sleep and wakefulness, this dreadful feeling that what I was dreaming about was in fact real, that I was a murderer, and it was only a matter of time until the whole world knew it. I shook my head and told myself I'd been dreaming, then rose from the tangled sheets and picked up my phone from the dresser. It was past 8, much later than I usually slept. Miranda's car service was coming at 8:30 to take her to Logan. I pulled on a pair of jeans and a cotton sweater and went downstairs. "Hey, sleepyhead," she said, when I'd found her in the formal dining room. She was sitting at the long, stickly table, her luggage by her side. She wore a short blue dress and a pair of red cowboy boots and was avidly studying her phone. "Aren't you cold in that?" She looked up. "Yes, but not for long. I'll tell the driver to turn the heat up to Miami temperatures." She turned her phone off, slid it into her purse, and stood. "What are you going to get up to while I'm away?" "First of all, you're always away, so this is nothing new. And second of all, work, obviously. You should have dinner with Mac tonight. I'm sure he's around." "He's not, actually. He's at his aunt's funeral. Remember I told you about that? Now I'm just going to take that lamb out of the freezer. Special dinner, just for me. Please, eat it all. Casey said we're going to Joe's Stone Crab tonight." I brought her luggage to the foyer, resisting the urge to comment on how heavy it was for a 3-day weekend. Miranda peered through the front door's leaded window. "Limo's here," she said, and pulled me in for an unusually tight hug. "I'll miss you, Teddy," she said. "How long exactly are you going for?" She slapped my chest. "Don't make jokes. I really am going to miss you. You're a good husband, you know." "I'll miss you too," I said, trying to get some feeling into my voice. The way Miranda was acting, I wondered briefly if the bachelorette party was made up. Was she meeting Brad down in Miami? Miranda pulled the front door open, and the driver jumped out of his town car, bounding up our steps to collect the luggage. Miranda followed him down to the car, a sharp wind plucking at the hem of her dress. She turned to wave at me, and she looked frail and cold in her inadequate clothes. Before I shut the door, she pulled her huge sunglasses out of her purse and put them on, then blew me a kiss. The day loomed before me. I had phone calls to make, and a prospectus to proofread, but that would only take about half a morning. I gathered a cup of coffee, then went to my computer. I Googled the name Lily Hayward for about the 100th time, but nothing came up that seemed like her, besides her job listing at Winslow College. I Googled